found a house and started a school, and we named it Providence Day.
You're hearing this straight from the horse's mouth. It's the official podcast of Providence Day School, bringing you spirited, informative, and entertaining conversations from the PD community. Now here's our host, a familiar face and voice on the PD campus, world language teacher, Jay Barron.
Welcome back to our conversation between the students for the political advancement of mankind at Providence Day. That's the group known as SPAM. And our two Charlotte City Council representatives. Tarek Bakari represents District 6, which includes Providence Day School, and Braxton Winston, who is both a PD parent and an at-large council member. During our recent virtual meeting, the six student officers of SPAM each had the opportunity to ask a question and hear their representatives' answers. And it was such a great conversation, it filled up two episodes. So now, let's rejoin the conversation for part two. Thanks for coming back. Davis Howard, I believe you're going to direct a more local question first to Mr. Bakari.
Yeah, so with like the current state of things between the upcoming election, the ruling on the Breonna Taylor case, and Donald Trump nominating someone for Supreme Court justice, there's likely to be more protests in Charlotte and other cities nationwide. How do you think the CMPD should handle future protests, and how should it change from how they handled them this summer? Because there are some accusations of police brutality or use of force.
Well, I'm sure Braxton will have a different angle on this than I will. I am of the personal mindset that we have done everything perfectly? No, of course not. But I think we are in the top 1% in the nation in how we've actually handled this locally. And my measurements are measured in how many people are dead. You go to other communities like Raleigh right now, buildings are boarded up. Literally, like things have been on fire, and people have gone after and burned police stations down, all this stuff. Like Charlotte, we've had pain, but we haven't had that kind of pain. So if we're measuring this in relation to not having anyone die locally during these things, allowing for as much as possible businesses to not bear the brunt of it, and they have, but not to the extent of others. I mean, if that's the basis of the question, in how are you going to, do you want CMPD to do something drastically different than they have for the last 4 months? I don't know what I'd ask them to do differently. Now, I know my colleagues, including Braxton, who I'm sure will have points, he's got a laundry list of things he'd like to change and would like them to do. I'll tell you, like a rap battle, you guys know rap battles, any good rap battle, you just lay out all the things that your opponent's going to say. Right. So he's going to say they shouldn't have tear gas and chemical munitions. But my rebuttal to that is, when you take non-lethal munitions out of that hand, what does it leave them with? Lethal munitions. And then they're in spots where whether, you know, you're talking about the June 2nd kettling incident or whatever it is. I mean, it's just, I think the broader point I'd say is, it seems like everybody in the world today, or in our nation and in our backyard, they seem to look at the same events and have two completely polar different views of them. And I don't know what else to attribute that to other than the really concerning scenario I see with the media right now. I think the media has gone off the deep end. And I mean, I've never been someone who's been a conspiracy theorist. Like I've never been one of the guys who's like, oh, that liberal rag, the Observer. But like, I've seen things these last 6 months personally where I'm like, how could you create that headline from this? And I see it every day. And every day I'm like, it's no wonder that there's no moderate middle ground anymore. And everyone has retreated to these polar opposites, even particularly on this topic of the police department. When the place most people are getting their information is either social media, where we know forces are giving false information, or the actual mainstream media, which is taking sides. So I don't know what else I'd say. I'm sure I'll be interested to hear what Braxton's point would be, but I think they've done an amazing job, and I would have just preferred we had their backs a little more through this whole process.
There has been a moderate side, and that's the reason that we've been here, that we end up here where we're at. No, it's not the media. This is real life people's lived experiences. You know, look, a definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results. The fact are that I have voted 3 times to give basically $1 billion, and Mr. Beccari has not made these votes to his credit. I've voted for a budget 3 years in a row that has given $1 billion to our CMPD, right? And we still have the issues of crime and homicides and this, that, and other, because this is not a law enforcement issue. Crime prevention will never be the role of law enforcement. It is their job to investigate and deliver evidence to the judiciary. What the U.S. Constitution says, only the judiciary, made up of the judge and jury, can take constitutional rights away and adjudicate whether or not crimes actually occur. Systemic racism is embedded in the organization that me and Mr. Beccari run. That is municipal government. And law enforcement arm has been one of the prime tools to express that racism. And again, this is not a necessarily a partisan issue. Democrats, Republicans, independents, Green Party, conservative, liberals, they've all been responsible for this. Look, I was talking to the police chief last week. You know, last year, CMPD spent 100,000 hours of police for law enforcement filling out accident reports. Look, we don't need that. We don't need, if you take away that responsibility and give it to a different body, well, you know what? You don't need a certain amount of officers that are going to do that. And then maybe you can put more resources behind, I don't know, doing things like solving crimes, like investigating homicides, investigating sexual assaults and clearing rape kits. But you also find different places that you can put resources. So this is largely, honestly, not an issue of policing. These are issues of political will to make changes, to go to your constituency and say, you know what? The police department does not need $300 million. We can spend these things through using different government services and provide a safer community and a more equitable community.
Let me jump in, if I could, please, Mr. Winston, because Ethan Pawk has a question that's very directly related to this, and you're already addressing some of what I know he wanted to ask about, and perhaps both of you could respond to what he wants to add to the conversation. Ethan?
So my question was directed to Councilman Winston. The new CMPD chief, Johnny Jennings, announced that Charlotte's police department was in, and I quote, official compliance with the 8 Can't Wait initiative, which is a set of 8 policy recommendations to reduce use of force by officers. I'm aware that in June, the city council passed this unanimously with, I believe, both of your votes. And while some may have celebrated this decision, some citizens are also aware that too much reform might handicap the CMPD during a challenging time. As Charlotte homicides almost doubled in 2019, accompanied by upticks in larceny and other types of crime. So my question was, how can the city best address concerns about police violence while keeping its citizens safe?
Again, you know, law enforcement does not prevent crime. It just don't. It's not a function of it. The deterrence, this idea again, that you can over police places and that will be a deterrence, is just false. If that was the case, we wouldn't have the issues that we had. I am not trying to reform the police. I'm trying to change what government's role in providing safe communities is. There's some things that can't be reformed. The use of chemical agents, what happened on June 2nd, can't be reformed. It has to be eliminated. It should not be a municipal service that we provide to the community of Charlotte. That 8 Can't Wait, I voted for it. I mean, but that was not something that I would propose. I mean, I think Chief Jennings will say That's just a start. That's a bare minimum. Those are like just basic understandings of what human dignity is, of how you should treat one another. It doesn't change anything. And on top of it, when you look at police law enforcement policy, it is so layered. It is so layered, so that if you change one thing, if you don't approach it from a systemic standpoint, then you're not really going to change anything. There will always be a different situation where that bad behavior can somehow be justified. You know, the whole idea of a use of force spectrum, that police have to justify the use of force from a verbal command all the way up to lethal force. Well, you can go from 0 to 100 by an emotion, because law says that I can look at a police officer a certain way and he can say that he feared for his life and therefore use lethal force. That cannot be reformed. That has to be changed completely. And people will be safer for it if we have better planned cities, if we have more economic opportunity and equity. If we solve food deserts, for instance, have you guys ever been those Snickers commercials? Those Snickers commercials are real, right? You ever been in class and you're starving and your teacher or your friend says something out of the way? You snap. Now imagine if you feel like that 24/7, 365. You know, when you get put in a stressful situation, you're going to do bad things. And that lies on people that sit in my and Mr. Bakari's seat and that have been sitting in those seats for years. Until we fix, for instance, in the Crescent, until we fix the outcomes that were caused from urban renewal, you know, from the 60s and 70s, we are not going to solve the issues that we have in some neighborhoods. And that is all the places that we need to focus on.
Mr. Bakari, that's a lot to respond to. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way for me to respond to it is read a headline. Minneapolis City Council alarmed by crime surge after defunding police. I mean, what do you think's going to happen when you don't have policing and public safety controls in place? And I mean, that's not a fake headline. That's literally a real headline. So,
but it's also fair to say, if I may, that we're talking, I think Mr. Winston is talking more about long-term causes and systemic attributes to this. Sure. How can we balance them?
You know, it's the funniest part of all this. And I think Mr. Winston would probably at least agree with half of what I'm going to say is most of everything you guys see in the general public is weaved up all for show. We've been doing literally all the things that in 2016 they created into a community letter to say, we've heard you. Everyone was already doing affordable housing and upward mobility and all these things. We've already been doing that now. People just try to put a moniker around, we've heard you. And therefore we're going to come into the opportunity zones or opportunity corridors. We're going to focus on workforce development. It's literally all the things that we've already been doing, and politicians decide to latch onto it and say, oh, there's a group of angry people. I can repackage up the same old tire playbook of what I've been doing and say, I've heard you. Here's my response. So I guess my question, going back to one of Councilman Winston's beautiful anecdotes earlier in quotes, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and thinking we're going to get different results. So what do you think is going to happen if the only net new thing we do is defund the police, back them away from enforcing things? The 8 Can't Wait is a huge win. And that wasn't an easy thing. It started to be an easy thing. It got into a lot more difficulty and they negotiated their way and changed policies to get there. But if we do all that, what's happening that makes you think that the systemic injustices and inequities in the system are somehow, even in the mid or long term, going to be solved? All we do is run around and throw band-aids on things with a divide between the have and have nots, whether it's the digital divide or the economic upward mobility divide or whatever, continuing to get worse and worse. So it's all nice to sit around and say, we have to solve that one thing that all these same politicians have all been trying to solve, or at least say they've been trying to solve for decades in order for this thing to work. But if we do them together, that's going to happen. No one's even close to solving that at all. So I'm not, in the meantime, going to throw the police under the bus and change their whole model in parallel to the hopes of somebody solving the impossible that all of these politicians have been saying they've been working on for 40 and 50 years, and nothing has changed.
Well, I will agree with some of Mr. Bukhari said. Like I said, it's not on one party. And that's why, again, I focus on systemic change. Many politicians, they don't want to focus on systemic change because that takes a long time and it takes comprehensive work. And you don't get the wins that you get to put on your campaign slogan every 2 years, right? Yeah. You don't get the headlines. For instance, me and Mr. Bukhari, we really want to focus on this digital divide. Because we know, right, that if you live in a certain neighborhood, right, you can't take advantage of, for instance, work from home options in the fintech world or in the financial services world, right? So you can have all of the financial literacy courses there. You can put all of the painting sidewalks and crosswalks there. But if you don't roll up your sleeves and do the hard work to change the way systems operate there, then the problem is going to continue to persist regardless of how many rallies that you have in those neighborhoods. And it's really hard to get people, regardless if they have the same political affiliation to you, to do that public servant work in that form and fashion.
We're going to, if I may, we're going to bring this to a close with a question from Katie Beeson. We started out with more of a national conversation, and now I would like to suggest that she's going to ask the most local question that exists. Okay, Katie, go ahead.
Yeah, as he said, thank you so much on behalf of the rest of the SPAM leaders. We always really look forward to the opportunities to be able to engage with our local leaders because we it's hard to discuss something if you don't have the ear or the voice of the person who's actually making the decisions. Now, we are SPAM leaders, but we are primarily students. So school is what takes up most of our lives. So my question for you is, well, first, Ms. Councilman Bukhari, where do your kids go to school? You said they're part of the CMS school system?
Yes, Selwyn.
Okay. Councilman Winston, as we know, your children go to Providence Day School. And as a member of the government, one might assume that you'd be one of the first to send your children to public school. But your kids do attend PD, and that's a school we're all a part of, and we're all very, very proud to be a part of. My question for both of you is, how did you make the decision to send your kids to private and public schools respectively? And what do you hope to change in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system in the future to try to ensure that all Charlottetown students have the same opportunities that we do here right now?
Thank you for that question. I'm a former CMS parent. My son went to Shamrock Gardens from kindergarten through third grade. I had the benefit of going to both New York City public schools, as well as a very prestigious high school, like Phillips Academy Andover. My mother is a retired high school math teacher, public school in New York City, and my grandmother is a retired middle school special education teacher from New York City. So I coveted my public school education. I think it really prepared me to take full advantage of the opportunities that I saw when I did get to the school that I went to. And it prepared me to deal with many different people. My public school in Brooklyn, it was not segregated. It was not segregated. We had, and that was a bit of a function of the time and place where I was. There was the white flight. It was pretty white at one point in time. A lot of Eastern European immigrants, you know, the legacy of the Holocaust and you know, those families, but then became very much West Indian over time and became less white as white flight happened. But to answer your question, that's what I really wanted for my kids. You know, I wanted the opportunity for them to have, I thought they were going to go through public school, and then go to Andover eventually. I ended up taking a job, you know, because I needed some extra money coaching at Providence Day. I knew somebody that was an assistant basketball coach and I saw this pop up. But the reason why I took my son out of CMS was because of the politics. And the changes that were happening that I saw were to the detriment of Black and brown kids. And so first and foremost, I tried to insert myself into the same groups and the same meetings that were happening to try to fight this, because my kid was going to be all right. His mother graduated, went to Columbia University. I went to Davidson. And she went to Andover as well. You know, so we knew that he was going to be all right. But when they stopped giving homework to kids, when they stopped teaching them and preparing them, when they started alienating families, and then they were putting my child up as, well, no, look, we're serving Black and brown kids. Look at Braxton. Look at little BJ. You know, he's doing excellent. You know, I was like, uh-uh. So we went from being the broad prize winner to seeing a systemic approach being manifested in my neighborhood school. And when I had the opportunity, to be a staff member at Providence Day to say, I'm not going to be a part of this. I'm going to be able to give him a better situation than the people that are taking the power in this CMS school than they're providing. I could not stand by and let my son be a political pawn, but also have a lower level of opportunity based on the politics of adults, you know, that were happening there. So I clawed and fought for a couple years to try to make it make sense. But there was a tipping point that I had to make the move that was in the best interest of my child. And I hate it. I hate Providence Day. It's been a great experience, but I hate that I had to take him out of it. And honestly, that my daughter probably will never get that experience that I had that was so important to me.
So you hate Providence Day?
It's no, I love Providence Day. I love it. But you know, I have to course correct my son quite often. You know, look. Yeah. You go to a school with I don't have the assets and means of a tip of what I think might be a typical Providence Day parent. You know, I'm a wage worker. I live check to check. I'm on, you know, so I have to course correct my children all the time. That just because you go there doesn't mean that you have the same opportunities or the folks that you go to school with have the same hardships in life than you do. And they never will. So it's a challenge. It is definitely a double-edged sword.
For me, it was a no-brainer and something I've always said I would always do. I grew up super, super duper poor. I went to a public school that wasn't very good. And I was one of the only people when I first moved into it in Stanton, Virginia, they called me an Aztec because they'd just never seen anyone that looked like me, and they just assumed that was my race. So it was interesting to go through that, but I never gave up on what I learned there, because aside from when you're in an environment like that, you're around everyday people, and it makes you hungry, but you don't get as good an education, which was clearly the case for me. But it teaches you, if you figure it out, how to operate around average everyday people, of which in the real world you're going to be surrounded by them. So I always put an extra emphasis there. I barely squeaked my way and got into college. I've been on my own since I was 16, paid, worked four jobs and at the same time to put myself through college. Radford University, again, you know, it's a crappy school. I mean, I love it. And I'm friends with a lot of the administrators and folks there now, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't UVA. It wasn't Davidson and the Wildcat. Every day it's a good day. But it taught me how to deal with real everyday people. And it gave me a chip on my shoulder and a hunger that when I got out of there, I was going to go crush it. And I was going to do everything I could to make something out of myself and change the trajectory that I'd grown up in my family. So when I did that and then we had kids, I had always said, my kids will go to public school. And I don't care. You know, we have the good fortune of being in a district that has a really good public school here. But even if that wasn't the case, my kids would still go to whatever the best public school around was, because I believe that you can always make up for some of the things you don't learn in the educational system, depending on its sophistication and where you are. You can never, ever relearn how to interact with people. that are different from you, that are from different backgrounds and upbringings. And I just see a future where I may not make my kids go to college. I may put together and save up the money for their college tuitions. And I could say, you can go start a company or you can go to college, because I believe this world is changing so dramatically that I don't know if you've seen The Sixth Sense, but college and four-year universities are in a large part like Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense. They're walking around and they're dead and they don't know it yet. I'm not saying that's going to obviously be the case, but if you are not mature enough to go into the private sector, maybe college is where you need to go. But there are a lot of people who end up wasting 4 years of a head start and crushing it that don't need to go there. And we're entering into more of a self-service education world, a place where you can teach yourself bites and chunks and go and get this here and that there while you work, while you make money, while someone will pay you to learn. So I always thought we can self-service learn and do things like that. He'll never learn how to be thrown in an environment with the kind of people he's going to come into contact with in the real world, or her, but all three of them. And because of that, and we've gone through pain, trust me, it's not been all pleasant, but I maintain my commitment to that. And I think it's important.
Gentlemen, we can't thank you enough. This has been a wonderful conversation for me. I don't know if any of the spam officers would like to sign off with you as well, but we just appreciate you very much. So thank you for joining us today.
And thank you, Senior Barron, for hosting this.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, all you Democrats, have fun.
I'm independent. Hey, I'm an independent.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of From the Horse's Mouth, our spirited official school podcast. Be sure to join us again to hear the voices of our global PD community. You can find episodes and more information at www.providenceday.org/podcast, or look for us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Our house was a very, very, very fine house, with classrooms in the den. Who could have guessed it then? And now everything is here because of you.